This is Jay Barrett. This week on the Kenai Conversation, I visit with two natural scientists intimately familiar with the Kenai Peninsula, retired Kenai National Wildlife Refuge ecologist Ed Berg and current supervisory wildlife biologist John Morton. We find out about spruce bark beetles, global warming, and the potential for a tsunami in Kachemak Bay, as well as the connection between wildfire and moose. It's a wide-ranging conversation about the natural world of the Kenai Peninsula. Well, Ed, I interviewed you before, 20-some years ago, probably about 20 years ago, about the ponds on the western side of the Kenai Peninsula here and how they're drying out. You wrote a refuge notebook column about them for the Peninsula Clarion. And at the time, what you wrote was, it's warming up. It's getting drier, and it's warming up, and these ponds are evaporating away. Global warming was just sort of, people knew about it back then, but now it's established science. Do you feel stronger than ever that that's what's going on with some of these things and maybe other things that are going on in the peninsula that that you've noticed in the interim?
Well, I think it's certainly true. Global warming has come onto the radar screen very much. So the drying ponds were one of the first things that I noticed here, that ponds that were blue on the old maps from the 40s and 50s, you know, were disappearing. So here at the latter part of the 20th century, these peat bogs are drying out and ponds are evaporating. And you can see this going on all over the Kenai now. These muskegs, as we call them, are becoming vegetated. Black spruce is rolling into them. And when we look at the climate records, especially for the Kenai weather station at the airport, we see that in 1968 and 69, there was a drought, you know, two summers of drought and a dry winter between them. And there was a tremendous fire in 1969 around Kenai that was a scorched earth fire. We only get these kind of fires under the driest conditions. And this is where everything burns right down to mineral soil. It's like the vegetative carpet has been picked up and taken out of the room. So there are thousands of acres of mud left behind, you know, when snow melts the next year. But the birch seed into that mud during the winter, and in that spring following, in 1970, here are baby birch coming up by the millions, you know, and they're about an inch high. And those birch grew up to provide this, what we call the 69 burn, and the moose and the hares loved eating all that birch. And of course, everything that eats moose and hares also enjoyed this as well, including human beings. So that was our primary hunting area there for many years. But the essentially, we never fully recovered from that drought. And when you calculate the amount of available water, as we call it, which is the water that's left over after precipitation has been evaporated and transpired by the plants, you know, during the summer, that available water went down by on the order of 50%. So there's just, you know, 50% less water on the landscape now for plant growth and streams and, you know, whatever else uses water. And so that has been the driver of this shrinking pond business and the muskegs drying out and so forth.
Now, do I understand you saying that the loss of the fire caused the more evaporation from the ground? Is that what you're saying?
No, the the more evaporation from the ground caused the fire. I mean, the landscape had really dried out, you know, in that that 2 year period, and allowed the fire to be much more consumptive, you know, than the normal spring fire.
But the subsequent loss of available water in the ground, was that a result of everything that happened because of the fire?
No.
No?
No, that was just a climatic effect.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ed, I've heard you talk about 1968 being sort of the reset point for the climate on the Kenai Peninsula. I mean, that's really what you're talking about here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Where that you went from, we went to a much drier and particularly warmer climate in the aftermath of 68. And so one of the things that we see in 69 is the fire, but that's a manifestation of the fact that the climate itself has changed. It's not that the fire drove the system. It was that the climate kind of reset.
Oh, okay. So right. It wasn't the fact that the ground was bare, that more water was evaporating and respiring and leaving less to soak into the ground to be available. It was we were getting drier overall, and the fire was, as you both have said, a result of that.
Right. Okay. When the air temperature is warmer, the plants breathe out more water. You know, they transpire more water. Just any gardener, you know, all knows this very well, and so the summers were warmer. But there was also somewhat less precipitation coming in. So maybe, you might say you were kind of equal parts of warming and less water, and that just the net effect of sort of greater expenditure and less income, you know, is a shortage. And,
yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, as an aside, and I only ask this since you folks have been with the refuge, which started as the moose range, I believe. Did the abundance of moose after that kind of spoil people here on the peninsula for having abundant moose? I mean, was it significantly more?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the moose population responded to an earlier fire, the 1947 fire, but that wasn't quite. It was a larger fire in the sense of the area covered. It was about 300,000 acres, and the 69 bird that Ed's talking about is somewhere around, what was it, 80 or 90,000 acres? 86,000 acres, I think, is the number we throw around. And so it was a smaller fire, but it was much more intense fire. And as a result of that, we got that hardwood regeneration that Ed's talking about, and the population really took off here in the 80s. And 90s. And so people that have moved in during that time window, they really got to experience lots of moose. And it really is an artifact of that fire.
Huh. Interesting. Interesting. And, of course, a lot of politics wrapped up in moose around here, you know, and a lot of decisions being made in Board of Game and all sorts of places. And some of it might be influenced by what people saw after that fire and, you know, the ensuing time after that. Did you have any thoughts on that, Ed?
No, it's definitely true. We've been spoiled for a long time. And, it's great while it lasts, but it's not the normal default condition.
The good thing about that is, you know, Ed, and Ed, you should probably talk more to this more specifically, but you know, a lot of Ed's work was to figure out the mean fire return interval for black spruce and white spruce and for hardwoods. And in that context, a lot of the black spruce that we have up in north of the Sterling Highway, up in subunit 15A, that mean fire return interval up there is about 80 years or so. And if you kind of date back to 1947, we're starting to come back into that period where we expect a big burn up in the 15A area any day now, literally.
Well, that's true. One of the tasks that I had early on was to look at this question of how often do we have fires? Because we knew fire was important from the 47 burn and the 69 burn. But we didn't know whether that was, you know, unusual. And Ted Bailey, my supervisor who hired me, was very interested in this because he felt we really had a very poor record of fire. And so I went to work on that and spent several, really off and on a number of years on that. One master's thesis project, Andy DeVolder worked on the black spruce that John was talking about. And that was fairly easily gotten at. There were a lot of fire scars on the black spruce. And if the fire, heats up one side, it'll make a scar. But if it doesn't, cook the other side, then the tree will continue to grow and the scar tissue will go around and maybe completely hide the scar. But after the 47 burn, we had a lot of black spruce poles standing on the Kenai. And you could see these sort of swollen bases on them where the old scars were. And it was just a perfect sampling opportunity. So Andy went out and cut hundreds of these poles down and measured the rings and dated the scars and got this like 300-year record of the fire history. Well, I used different techniques to look at a much longer record, and especially lake sediment cores provide us the longest record. And so there was a lake out on Swanson River Road that we call Paradox Lake, and we got a 13,000-year record of fire from the charcoal in that lake. And this was a project by Scott Anderson at Northern Arizona University. So we could see that in the early period, let's say, 13,000 to 4,000 years ago, the fire frequency was fairly high, but then in the last 4,000 or 5,000 years, it had come down to a pretty stable level that is probably what we see today. And the fire return interval there was like 130 years on average between fires. Well, on the southern peninsula, we suspected that didn't burn very often because we just never saw any burned wood lying around on the ground. And so there, we used charcoal in the soil. And there was a tremendous area east of the Nilchik on Native Corporation land that was logged. And the birch trees were left behind. They were of no interest to the loggers. But having removed all the spruce, the birch were pretty vulnerable to wind throw. And so thousands of birch trees were blown down within the several years of the logging. Well, each time a birch tree fell down, it turned up a throw mound. So this is a quick and dirty way to get a hole dug in the ground. So we drove along these logging roads and we would stop every half mile or so and get out with our little trowels and we would dig around in these throw mounds and find charcoal flakes. And then we used radiocarbon dating to date those. And we found out indeed that their fire was really quite rare in this environment. And we figured that the fire return interval was something like 400 to 600 years. But there were sites that hadn't burned for almost 3,000 years down there. So entirely different fire regime from what we have, up in the more central part of the peninsula. Across Kachemak Bay, I don't think the forest there has ever burned. It's probably just too wet.
That always reminds me a lot of Kodiak Island, and then over towards southeast from there.
Well, Kodiak is an interesting situation because the Sitka spruce is still recruiting and advancing west on Kodiak. It started on the east side and it's moving across Kodiak. And again, I don't think there's much history of fire there.
Not much. 12 years I was there, we had one big fire, and that was two years ago. And it wasn't that big. It burned down a library.
Well, you know, the difference here on the Kenai is the eastern side of the peninsula, the Seward side, is all Sitka. You know, it's basically the northern extreme of the coastal rainforest that goes all the way down to Northern California. And that's a very wet environment, and fire is not a player typically in a rainforest, which is a little bit more like Kodiak. When you come over on the western side, you know, we have enough of a sort of a microclimate change from going from Homer all the way up to past Nikiski and, you know, on up to Point Possession. Then the northern part that Ed was describing, the 15A, Unit 15A, which is black spruce, it's a much, you know, that's a very fire-driven system. The middle part there, 15B, kind of between Tustamina and Skelak, is more of a white spruce complex, a little bit slower fire regime, but it's got some big white black spruce patches in that. And then by the time you get down to the south towards Caribou Hills and what Ed was describing with these very long mean fire return intervals there, you're kind of bleeding into what we call Lut spruce, which is the hybrid between Sitka and white spruce. And it's, and the reason why you have the hybrid there is because it's a little bit moister down there.
Are the fire intervals that you discovered through these cores and through the charcoal, are they significantly different or different at all than what the fire intervals are believed to be now? Like 80 years for here, did you say they were 130 X number of thousand years ago?
Right. Well, boy. You know, since the bark beetles, we've had a number of spring fires, you know, dry grass fires before green up. And so, especially on the southern peninsula, we've definitely changed the fire interval down there because of these grass fires. So it's definitely a warmer climate now. One of the questions that came up, you know, during the bark beetle period about, you know, just how susceptible are we to fire? And that was a big political issue here. Well, so another one of my tasks at the refuge was to ask, you know, how often have we had spruce bark beetle outbreaks? Because we really had very little idea about that. We knew in the 1970s that there had been some bark beetle outbreak on the northern Kenai Peninsula. And we knew in the 1920s in the Copper River Valley, there'd been a fairly heavy outbreak there. That started around the Kennecott mine, you know, in McCarthy. And they cut a lot of timber for that mine, and they just left the slash, you know, piled up. And bark beetles love freshly cut timber, and they love slash. So they, you know, took off right around the time of the building of that Kennecott copper mine. But other than those events, you know, we really didn't have much of an idea. So I used a tree ring method to look for past outbreaks. And essentially, bark beetles are distinct because they kill the large trees, and they leave pole-sized trees, the understory trees that have been suppressed by, you know, the shade of the big neighbors. Well, those guys will tend to survive, and then they release. They start growing much faster once they're getting sunlight and more water. So fairly early on, we saw a really spectacular example of this in Homer. We had a clear-cut in the mid-90s in Homer on the west side of town, and everyone was horrified. This was the first serious logging that was done in Homer. It was right on the highway in a total eyesore. And it, you know, provided several acres of stumps. So I enlisted a couple of the local loggers to come in and cut cookies or slabs off these stumps so we could count and measure the tree rings. And we had Homer High School students out there involved in this as a biology project as well. And they, you know, counted, I think we did 550 slabs off this several acres. Well, you could see about 1884, there was a tremendous growth release. And the inside, you know, the very center of the tree, the rings were really tight. You needed a microscope to see them. But when the trees got to be, or when that inner part got to be about 3.5 inches in diameter, then the rings became very wide, like, you know, a quarter of an inch or even a half an inch wide. I mean, it was a phenomenal release. That sure looked like, a profound thinning of the canopy had taken place at that time. But there are other ways, you know, you can have a blowdown, for instance, that goes through and blows down the big trees and leaves the little guys, you know, standing. And so, you know, that was another hypothesis. We were fortunate to have buried in the files at the Kenai Refuge a 1907 Forester's Report. And this was written by a man named William Langeel, who was sent by Gifford Pinchot, who was the founder of the Forest Service, about that same time. Langeel was commissioned to inventory the forest resources on the Kenai and other places in Alaska. Now, Langeel was not a trained forester, but he was an excellent woodsman. He'd been a gold miner. He came from a very good family in Oregon that ran a prominent lodge in the mountains to which scientists and other luminaries came. So he'd met a lot of interesting people in his youth and was a really sharp guy. And so he wrote this paper in 1904, which described basically the decimated forest conditions on the Kenai. But specifically, it talked about the standing dead trees between Homer and Anchor Point. The fact that the trees were standing was very important because that ruled out the blowdown hypothesis. And he also talked about how the young trees coming up were not thrifty. They had a lot of limbs. You know, foresters don't like limbs. I mean, limbs make knots, you know. So this is a critical appraisal of the forest, but under it, they were not thrifty, and they had a strong taper as well. Well, again, you know, when you're cutting boards out of a tree, you like to have the sides parallel and not a lot of taper. But at any rate, it described exactly what you would expect after the beetles had gone through maybe 20 years before, which indeed they had. Now we also found a few still standing trees there that we could determine the death date, and the death date was 1884, and you could see the old beetle scars on the trees. You know, so I always say that's as close as we ever got to the smoking gun.
There were still standing trees from 1884, still standing?
Well, the thing is, they were leaner poles. They had rotted off at the base, but they were captured by their neighbors and held up, you know, not completely vertical, you know, but, yeah, you can see these things in the woods today. And you know, we can determine the death date of a tree by measuring the tree rings and then comparing that with living trees. So I have a chronology. I mean, if you bring me a piece of wood that has, let's say, 100 rings on it, and it's died within the last 350 years on the Kenai, I can tell you when that tree died, you know.
Wow.
And this is a very standard technique in dendrochronology, and it's used for Stradivarius violins and things like that as well. It's a very powerful technique. The archaeologists, you can imagine, use this a lot. And that convinced us that we had a really major outbreak in the 1880s. And then I went on, and I could see smaller growth releases back in the 1820s and so forth, somewhere around the 1910s as well. Then I had an opportunity to go over on the other side of Cook Inlet to go to Katmai and Lake Clark Park there with the Park Service. And we did similar studies there. So really we have a very good idea of, let's say, the last 300 years, certainly, of bark beetle outbreak in Cook Inlet. And we can see that, yeah, the beetles have definitely been here before. And they'll be here again, as they are starting to be as we speak.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I had John and the state forester,
Hans,
over here. And I found out something that I didn't know. I had always thought that spruce bark beetles, you know, maybe arrived, you know, in a crate from China or something, you know, as a stowaway. But apparently they've been around. They just come and go, right? Or thrive and die off when they thrive when the conditions are right, and they die off after they've eaten everything. Is that the deal?
Well, that is the deal. Certainly in this last case, they did manage to eat themselves out of house and home, you know, quite effectively. And normally, they don't go quite that far. But what drives them here are warm summers, and in particular, runs of warm summers, you know, 2, 3, 4 warm summers. Like this present outbreak that we're having now, there was three summers that were really quite warm in a row. And the temperature threshold for that is 51 degrees of the average summer temperature in Homer. You know, that's what we've correlated that to. And, you know, when that, you get several years above 51 degrees, then the bark beetles start building up. Now, the thing is, with the outbreak in the 1990s, the forest really hadn't been severely thinned since the 1880s. So it was overstocked, you might say. The foresters would call it that, or overmature. There was a lot there to eat. And we had 11 years of warm summers in a row. And the beetles just, you know, built up more and more every year. And they did finally eat themselves out of house and home.
Jay, what I was going to say is what Ed does in the kind of research he's done over the years is that, you know, he's kind of what he does is he identifies, or he, you know, he actually records the historic rate of returns for different natural processes on the Kenai, whether it's fire or spruce bark beetle. And what this does is it forms the basis then by which we judge what's happening in current times to see if there's a change, right? And so when you originally asked that one question about, you know, what do we see now that's different, like in the context of fire, part of the problem is that when you see the kind of research, you know, I call it detective work that Ed's doing, is it's measured, you know, in decades, if not centuries, right? So when you start getting rapid change like we have, you know, on the Kenai in the last, depending on what your time frame is, but say if we go back to Ed's 1968 set point, you know, not enough time has passed to actually show it statistically. And so it doesn't show up in the record, but the reality is that we're seeing the footprint all around us. And a good example on the fire side of the business is that I can think of a few examples that kind of jump out at me. One is the Irish Channel fire in Skelak that burned in 2005 from a lightning fire. That was in a hemlock stand. And hemlock doesn't have a mean fire return interval for all practical purposes. It doesn't burn, at least historically. And so there's a fire that burned. And was that a one-time thing? No, it wasn't, because just 2 or 3 years ago, we had the Stetson Creek fire up by Cooper Landing. And that was that's in hemlock, too. That was a lightning ignition. And that, too, took off, and that was a hemlock fire. And then the other one that I think is kind of stunning to me is at the tail end of the 2014 Funny River fire, which you know, it was human caused, and it started in a black spruce patch, but then ended up burning about a 200,000 acre fire footprint. At the very tail end of that, it was actually burning in alpine tundra up in the Tustamina benchlands, and that too is unusual. So we see these little weird things that are kind of popping up. That's not normal. That's not normal business.
Mm-hmm. And are we the scientists of the world, you know, perhaps focus down to yourself, Ed. Is this global warming? Are we seeing it? I mean, is this an effect of global warming? These unusual things that John is talking about.
Oh, I think it definitely is. I mean, we're seeing so much of this going on in so many places around the world that it is. I mean, these changes occur on long time scales, but the recent time scale has been such rapid acceleration. I mean, like the wetlands that we started talking about, I mean, for, let's say, 17,000 years, we've got these, you know, soggy peat bogs out there. There's no black spruce growing in them, and you better have your extra tufts on if you're going to be wading around out there. But suddenly, you know, in recent decades, they're drying out, and you can go out there in your tennis shoes, and the black spruce is moving in, and I don't know, the snow machiners love driving over these muskegs in the wintertime, but, you know, in another 30 or 40 years, they're going to be wall-to-wall black spruce. You know, the snow machiners are going to have to cut their paths through there. They won't just be able to sail on the muskeg. And so that's a pretty dramatic change after, 17,000 years of stability.
Can we expect and here I'm drawing on your botany experience, a change in the kinds of trees growing here? Can we expect more Sitka spruce, say, in this area, and what have you, and, you know, black spruce moving further north? Or,
well, both John and I have pondered this vegetation change at some length, certainly as far as the you know, the white spruce and the Lutz and the Sitka, they're not going to get very big anymore. After about 2030, the climate models all indicate that the summers will always be above that 51-degree threshold. So the beetles will be there to eat anything that gets bigger than about 6 inches or so. So, you know, white spruce, Lutz, Sitka can be planted and grown and harvested for pulp, you know, but we're never going to get, you know, these grand, huge old spruce trees that we've seen before. We're also thinking that the fire frequency is going to increase a lot, you know, with the drier climate. And so that will probably produce, you know, more of those severe mineral soil exposing fires that I talked about, like the 1969 burn, and that will produce a lot more birch and cottonwood and aspens as well, but, you know, hardwoods. And, you know, that will be great for the moose. Now, whether other species will be moving in, you know, entirely new ones, is tougher to say. I mean, certainly people are planting a lot of things. People are planting, you know, lodgepole pine and Siberian larch and so forth, but we've yet to see how well they propagate on their own. I mean, lodgepole pine in the lower 48 is pretty much a fire-dependent species. It has these cones that need fire to open them up, you know, and melt the resins. And so, you know, whether that will be a self-sustaining kind of tree and forest remains to be seen.
Can I ask you about the spruce and the beetles? I guess I'm just discovering that the beetles don't care what kind of spruce as long as it's the right size. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, they don't really eat black spruce. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a few kind of ambiguous reports of them being in black spruce. There are other, you know, beetles that can eat black spruce, but they definitely affect the white and the Sitka, and then the hybrid between them, the Lutz.
Ah.
Yeah.
Why aren't spruce bark beetles a problem then, say, in Kodiak or Sitka with the Sitka spruce?
It probably rains too much.
Oh.
Yeah, just like over on the east side of the peninsula.
Oh, okay, so it has to be warm and dry.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, there was a time in the early 1990s when the entomologists came from Anchorage and you know, they said in Homer, you know, you guys will never have a problem with the bark beetle down here. It rains too much in Homer, you know, and of course in Homer, yeah, it does rain a lot. And we thought, well, okay, we're spared. But unfortunately, they didn't account for the warming aspect of it. And
boy, I remember those mountainous piles of sawdust and logs on the spit there for years there down there. They're huge.
Mount Chipmore, the chip pile, right. <yeah. laughs>
Ed, right. This might be a good segue for you to talk about the Gruink glacier work that you're doing, because it's kind of related to this whole climate change piece.
Well, it is. This is definitely a climate change wrinkle. Gruink Glacier is Homer's pet glacier. I mean, you can see this from Homer. I can look out my picture window there in Homer and see Gruink Glacier. And it's a very popular day trip to go over there with a water taxi and hike up to the lake in front of the glacier. And yeah, it's just really it's kind of a spectacular feature. Well, the lake has been getting bigger there because the glacier is pulling back. And the glacier is, the lake, let's say the glacier has pulled back about a mile and a half since 1967. And the reason for 1967 date is that in 1967 there was a major avalanche into the lake. Basically, the face of the mountain ridge there collapsed and slid into the lake, partially onto the toe of the glacier, which was at that point. But it created a terrific water wave that ran like 200 feet up the hillside and scalped off all the spruce trees. And then this wave rolled down the outwash plain and carried these spruce trees into Kachemak Bay. It also rolled into Humpy Creek, which is on that same outwash plain, and wiped out a year's worth of salmon in Humpy Creek. Well, fortunately, this happened late in the fall. It was a rainy October, and nobody was over there in the way, or they would have been washed out to Kachemak Bay. And well, the lake, like I say, has pulled back maybe a mile and a half past that point since 1967. And it's exposed a much steeper and higher ridge, which basically it goes up to about 3,000 feet along there. And the angle is, 45 degrees in some places. Well, we were curious to know how deep is the lake. Could another bigger wave be created? Well, okay, last summer we got out there with pack rafts, and the Kenai Refuge lent us a fish finder. This is a sonar depth gauge which records a GPS position and the depth. So the commercial fishermen all have these in Homer, and a lot of, you know, private fishermen too, for that matter. It's just a wonderful piece of technology. So I built a little wood frame on my pack raft, and I would hold the instrument kind of between my knees and paddled around. We spent 3 days of going back and forth across the lake, you know, getting these depth soundings. Well, it was surprising to see that the lake was a lot deeper than we thought. There was a fairly flat floor out there at about 425 feet, and the deepest point up close to the ice front was like 500 feet. I was expecting maybe 150 or 200. Well, the glacier has come and gone many times. We really don't have a clue how many times, but it has gouged out this deep basin. Tustamina Lake is another example of this on a larger scale. I think the depth of Tustamina is like 900 feet plus, and that too has been gouged out by repeated comings and going of Tustamina Glacier. Well, okay, so we now have a 500 feet of water sitting at the base of a 3,000-foot steep cliff. The lake, I don't know, let's say it's 2 miles long or something now, but it's really a dangerous setup for another landslide. The rock is highly fractured. You can see just faults running all over the place. And if it was to, let's say the top of the ridge, you know, was to fall from 3,000 feet into 500 feet of water, you can imagine the size of the wave that it would create. So we've actually got a couple of modelers now to do some computer simulations of this. But because it's such a popular place, there are 20 or 30 hikers a day going over there in the summertime. Potentially the wave could be big enough that it could impact the Homer Harbor as well. So the question is, you know, can you, you know, predict or forecast this kind of thing? And there are many places, well, especially in Europe, where people have been studying this, and we're hoping to get some instruments in place that would monitor creep of the rocks, in essence, and also using like satellite imagery and possibly video imagery as well, just to see whether there's movement going on the face of this steep mountainside. And if there is, you know, then we would want to instrument that more closely and try and set up some sort of warning signal that could be generated.
John?
Yeah, I was just going to say that one of the extraordinary pieces about this story that Ed was just telling was not really the glacial piece, but a lot of people may not appreciate that Ed is well into his, I guess, seventh decade now of life. He's no longer a young man, and he's out there in pack rafts floating around, you know, trying to take measurements on this stuff. And there's not very many people that do that kind of thing at any point in their lifetime, let alone well into their, headed towards the far side of 80.
Well, it sounds like it kind of goes hand in hand with Ed, your educational and your background. Could you tell us a little bit of something about that? The things you've studied. You told me before we went on the air that you studied geology, and when you became an ecologist here, how did that help you?
Well, I am a geologist by training. That was my first science, and I've returned more and more to it since retirement here. I studied geology and geophysics at Indiana University, and then I went on to the University of Wisconsin and studied earthquake seismology there. I didn't pursue that professionally at the time. This was during the Vietnam War. I was very much opposed to the Vietnam War, and I was part of the protesters in Madison, Wisconsin, and getting beaten up by the cops. And but yet I was working in this laboratory that was totally funded by the military. We had no interest in the military applications, but everything we were working on had military applications, and I just thought, boy, I don't want to make a career out of working on things that basically are going to be killing people in the long run. And so instead of getting a PhD in geophysics, which I was well on the road to, I ended up getting a PhD in philosophy, which had been an interest of mine. And but philosophy of science, for sure. But that that was a very interesting thing to do, but the idea of making a career out of that and being a philosophy professor, I just decided I didn't want to do that. So I became a carpenter instead. I had friends, carpenter friends, and they took me on as a trainee. And I worked for many years as a carpenter, and I thoroughly loved it. I'm building an addition on my house right now, even though the weather's cold, and I'm back into the carpentry mode. After I moved to Alaska and had been working as a carpenter, I got to teaching geology at the college in Homer, and I decided to go back to graduate school. But I'd gotten interested in plants in the meantime, and you know, I probably would have been a biologist if it hadn't been for Sputnik. But I was in high school when Sputnik went up, and even though I had taken the year's course in biology and thoroughly loved it, the emphasis was on, you know, the physical sciences in those days. And since I was very interested in geology, a member of the cave exploring club and things like that in Indiana, I ended up, you know, going more to the physical sciences side than the biological side. But I still was interested in plants. And when I went to school in Fairbanks there one winter, I took some plant courses as well as volcanology and plate tectonics and things like that. But I said, well, I'll just I'll get a master's degree in botany, and it's something I could do in the winter there, starting like in January after I had, you know, worked in the fall. And so I ended up getting a master's degree in botany, and that was really neat, and I got very excited about that. But I thought, if I'm going to actually be employed doing botany, I've got to get a PhD in this. And I want to go to some place that has more plants than Alaska. So I went to the University of Georgia, which had a terrific botany department, and a lot more plants, and a terrific botany in the southeastern United States. Well, there I got interested in statistics. Now, I had not appreciated statistics before. I mean, when I worked in geophysics, we used to say, if the data is so bad that it requires statistics, we will redo the experiment. We'll go out and remeasure this business. Well, when I got to biology, the data was always so bad that it required statistics to make any sense out of it at all. You know, is this different from just a random process? You know? So I ended up getting a master's degree in statistics. Well, okay, so I finished a PhD in botany at the University of Georgia, and I saw advertised this job at the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, which was close to Homer. And I thought, wow, that could be very interesting. And I applied, and lo and behold, I got that job. And So
let me jump in here and give people a little perspective on that. So you get the picture that Ed, for most of his life, he was a Suzuki parent, and he was a professional student, and he pounded nails. Okay, so when he started at the refuge, he was 50 years old. This is the time when most people are thinking about retirement. Okay, so this is his first job as a scientist, near as I can tell. And he's not a young guy, and he worked there for about 20 years. And when Ed retired a few years ago, you were closing in on 70 there, weren't you?
No, I was 70. Right,
you were 70. Yeah. So, you know, he's putting together the ecology, the paleoecology of the Kenai Peninsula at a time when most people, you know, they're drinking margaritas down at the bar, right? So it's pretty extraordinary.
Wow, pretty good for a second, third, fourth, or fifth career. I'm not sure which it was, but pretty good.
Well, no, it's been interesting and a lot of fun. I could probably have accomplished more if I had focused on one thing and stuck with it, as most people typically do. But I've had a very interesting life, and I really don't think I have any complaints.
You know, you'll be well regarded as the Kenai Peninsula's foremost polymath.
When I came to the refuge with this unusual background, I think that was very useful, because the refuge, well, I was the first ecologist there. They'd never had an ecologist before, but Ted Bailey wanted somebody who could look at kind of the bigger picture, not just how many moose have we got, you know, how many caribou, but what is happening with the general setting of all these critters. And having the background as a geologist was very good, because it made me look to the past and ask, well, where have we come from? I mean, how have the conditions of today developed, you know, over, you know, the last few thousand years or so? And so I brought what you might call a paleo perspective, as in paleontology, you know, old, you know, looking back at the past. And I am, I guess, essentially a historian of the landscape, you might say. Well, at first this was kind of a, you know, esoteric sort of approach. But as global warming came onto the radar screen, we're starting to look and ask, well, okay, where are we headed? And, you know, the best way to figure out where you're headed is to look back and see what kind of trajectory you are on. And so that's where a lot of my, you know, rather esoteric paleo projects, like fire history and bark beetle history and peatlands and so forth, that became relevant to projecting and actually trying to model, you know, where we will be going in the future.
Yeah, you know, I give a lot of talks on climate change and climate adaptation, and I often preface the presentations with the fact that outside of the high Arctic, where you have a lot of international consortiums doing research, the Kenai is probably the next best studied place in Alaska, and it's really due to Ed. And Ed and his colleagues, people like Roman Dial and folks down at Arizona State University, or Northern Arizona State University, and that's he has positioned us to do a lot of the things that we still do today.
Wow, when you look back at the research you've done, you look at the was it the Pleistocene and all this you know from there to now in the natural record, is the arc we're on, how steep of a curve is it on, and how long of a time frame is that?
Well, the curve is getting pretty steep, let's put it that way. The Kenai began to warm up in the kind of at the end of the Little Ice Age, say in the 1850s, we start seeing, for instance, a lot of recruitment of black spruce into the wetlands starting in the 1850s. And then we, you know, see the bark beetle outbreak of the 90s and so forth. But it just seems to me that the rate of change itself is changing. You know, we really are on an accelerating and exponentially turning upward curve, and I find that scary. It's very hard to model curves like that. We see these global climate models, and the global climate models all seem to end at 2099. Well, of course, you know, life continues on and past the end of the 21st century.
Fingers crossed.
All right. But the modelers don't have the nerve to run their projections beyond that. But part of the reason they are conservative about that is that there are a lot of positive feedback mechanisms in the systems. I mean, one of the most well-known one is the melting of the Arctic ice. You know, as long as you have that nice shiny ice out there, it reflects the sunlight back and helps, you know, preserve the ice. But once you have gotten rid of the ice, the sunlight warms up the dark water very effectively and melts, you know, any remaining ice. So that's a strong positive feedback mechanism that, you know, we're really seeing now, this rapid melting of the Arctic ice, and it's melting much faster than anyone would have predicted, you know, even 10 years ago. But there are many other positive feedback systems. There's the melting of the permafrost, which you know, methane, a potent greenhouse gas, into the atmosphere, and of course that warms the atmosphere, and that increases the melting of the permafrost, and so on. And you've got another positive feedback, or vicious circle, I guess is a more common name for that. Human population growth itself is a positive feedback, as long as families are having more than two children, more than the zero population growth standard, you know, then those children are producing more children, and, you know, you've got this exponentially increasing system. So, you know, if you're going to be a climate modeler, you have to model those positive feedbacks in the system, and that requires a lot of assumptions. So my concern is that the climate modelers are too conservative, and things may be warming up, you know, worldwide a lot faster than they've been modeled to be. And it seems like, you know, the processes that they're looking at, the melting of the Arctic ice, the melting of the Antarctic ice cap, I mean, these things are all going faster, you know, than the modelers thought. So, I'm worried about, you know, where things are headed on the global climate scale.
Well, thank you both very, very much. You've been listening to the Kenai Conversation. My guests have been retired Kenai National Wildlife Refuge ecologist Ed Berg and supervisory wildlife biologist John Morton. I'm Jay Barrett.